Bone Black by Bell Hooks. Chapter 2. We live in the country. We children do not understand that that means we are among the poor. We do not understand that the outhouses behind many of the houses are still there because running water came here long after they had it in the city. We do not understand that our playmates who are eating laundry starch do so not because the white powder tastes so good, but because they are sometimes without necessary food. We do not understand that we wash with the heavy, unsmelling, oddly shaped pieces of homemade lye soap comes from. We never think about where lye soap comes from. We only know we want to make our skin itch less, that we do not want our mouths to be washed out with it. Because we are poor, because we live in the country, we go to the country school, the little white wood frame building where all the country kids come. They come from miles and miles away. They come so far because they are black. As they are riding the school buses, they pass school after school where children who are white can attend without being bussed, without getting up in the wee hours of the morning, sometimes leaving home in the dark. We are not bussed. The school is only a mile or two away from our house. We get to walk. We get to wander aimlessly in the road until a car comes by. We get to wave at the buses. They are not allowed to stop and give us a ride. We do not understand why. Daddy says the walk to school will be good for us. He tells us again and again in a harsh voice of the miles he walked to school through fields in the snow without boots or gloves to keep him warm. We are not comforted by the image of the small boy trudging along many miles to school so he can learn to read and be somebody. When we close our eyes, he becomes real to us. He looks very sad. Sometimes he cries. We are not at all comforted. And there are still days when we complain about the walk, especially when it is wet and stormy. School begins with chapel. There we recite the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. We have no feelings for the flag, but we like the words. Said in unison, they sound like a chant. We then listen to a morning prayer. We say the Lord's Prayer. It is the singing that makes morning chapel the happiest moment of the day. It is there I learned to sing Red River Valley. It is a song about missing and longing. I do not understand all the words, only the feeling. Warm, wet sorrow, like playing games in spring rain. After chapel, we go to classrooms. In the first grade, the teacher gives tasting parties. She brings us different foods to taste so that we can know what they are like because we do not eat them in our homes. All of us eagerly await the Fridays when the tasting part will begin. The day she brings cottage cheese, I am not sure I want to try it. She makes me. She makes everybody try a little bit, just in case they might really like it. We go home from the tasting parties, telling our parents what it was like, telling them to buy this new food, better than any food we have ever tasted. Mama tells us that most of the food we taste isn't good to eat all the time, that it is a waste of money. We do not understand money. We do not know that we are poor. We cannot visit many of the friends we make because they live miles and miles away. We have each other after school. Chapter 3. Here at the country school, we must always work to raise money, selling candy, raffle tickets, having shows for which tickets are sold. Sold to our parents, neighbors, friends, people without money who are shamed into buying little colored paper they cannot afford. Tickets that will help keep the school going. The people with lots of money can buy many tickets, can show that they are big time. Their flesh is often the color of pigs in the storybook. Somehow, they have more money because they are lighter, because their flesh turns pinker and pinker, because they dye their hair blonde, red, to emphasize the lightness of their skin. We children think of them as white. We are so confused by this thing called race. We learn about color with crayons. We learn to tell the difference between white and pink and a color they call flesh. The flesh-colored crayon amuses us. Like white, it never shows up on the thick manila paper they give us to draw on, or on the brown paper sacks we draw on at home. Flesh, we know, has no relationship to our skin, for we are brown, and brown like all good things. And we know that pigs are not pink or white like these flesh people. We secretly love pigs, especially me. I like to watch them lie in mud, covering themselves in the cool red mud that is flaming red hot, like dirt on fire. I like to watch them eat, to feed them. For some weeks now, I have been feeding them the coal that is our way of keeping warm in the winters. I give them little pieces at a time to hear the crunching sound. I want to give them all the tickets to eat so no one will have them to sell, so Mama will not have to complain about the way it adds to her worries that she must now sell tickets. The pigs are disgusted by the tickets. Even when I prod them with a stick, they only turn away. They would rather eat coal. I must sell tickets for a Tom Thumb wedding, one of the school shows. It isn't funny for children. We get to dress up in paper wedding clothes and go through a ceremony for the entertainment of the adults. The whole thing makes me sick, but no one cares. Like every other girl, I want to be the bride, but I am not chosen. It has always to do with money. The important roles go to the children whose parents have money to give, who will work hard selling tickets. I am lucky to be a bridesmaid, to wear a red crepe paper dress made just for me. I am not thrilled with such luck. I would rather not wear a paper dress, not be in a make-believe wedding. They tell me that I am lucky to be lighter-skinned, not black-black, not dark brown. Lucky to have hair that is almost straight. Otherwise, I might not be in the wedding at all. Otherwise, I might not be so lucky. This luck angers me. And when I am angry, things always go wrong. We are practicing in our paper dresses, walking down the aisle while the piano music plays a wedding march. We are practicing to be brides, to be girls who will grow up to be given away. My legs would rather be running, itch to go outdoors. My legs are dreaming, adventurous legs. They cannot walk down the aisle without protest. They go too fast. They go too slow. They make everything slow down. The girl walking behind me steps on the red dress. It tears. It moves from my flesh like wind, moving against the running legs. I am truly lucky now to have this tear. I hope they will make me sit. But they say no, we would not think of taking you out of the show. They know how much every girl wants to be in a wedding. The tear must be mended. The red dress, like a woman's heart, must break silently and in secret. Chapter 4. Where they live on the hill, there are few houses around. All the land is owned by one black man who lives not far away from them in a big house with no other houses around. He also lives high on a hill. Their house is made of stone and concrete. White men built it when they began to work to see if oil could be found on the hill. Oil was never found. They left remnants of their machinery, of their presence. They left the cold concrete house. In the hot, humid summer, the coolness inside was like refrigeration. But in winter, it was cold and damp. The cold grayness of the house had little impact on them. They were always playing outside, playing in the green grasses and hills above the house. They walked for miles into the hills, looking for honeysuckle and wild asparagus, trying to stay out of the way of snakes. They were not always afraid of snakes, but they knew to be careful, knew that snake bite could be dangerous. She liked to talk to a favorite tree up the hill and play with a bright snake that lived there, a green tree snake. She knew how to talk to the snake and how to listen. She told the snake about the problem she was having, learning her left from her right. The snake understood her frustration, her tears, when everyone was ready to go and she was still struggling to put her shoes on the correct foot. The snake understood the punishments did not make the task easier. She felt it was the shoes, big Buster Brown shoes that she and her brother wore. Wrapped around her wrist like a bracelet, the green tree snake told her to take those shoes every day and put them on the trash, that maybe they would burn them along with all unwanted things. Every night, she sneaked out of the house and placed the shoes neatly on the pile of trash to be burned. Every morning, she was punished and made to get the shoes. She continued until finally her daddy said, "Buy her another pair of shoes." She was considered a problem child, a child intent on getting her own way. That day, she wandered alone to thank the green snake for helping her. On her way home, she found a new path. Without thinking, she followed it. The path led to a huge garden. She did not know who had planted it. She walked slowly down row after row, watching the growing plants, making sure not to step on them. Walking down the rows made her dizzy. Maybe that was why she stumbled and fell, scraping both knees on the gravel and dirt as she rolled a bit down the hill. She lay crying, lost and alone. The someone who picked her up was a man she did not know. He was not an old man. His skin was pink like the pigskin. His hair was black and curly. When he picked her up, he told her he was carrying her home. She was sure the snake had sent him. She told him all about the snake, how it was her one true friend. He laughed, asking her if he could be her friend. She was sure about snakes, not about strange men. So she said nothing. He carried her all the way home. They had been searching the hills for her, calling her name. At home, the man introduced himself as the landlord's son. Before he left, he promised to marry her, to come back when she was older. The grown-ups seemed to think this was a good idea. She whispered a secret in his ear. She told him that she could not marry him because she had already promised the snake that they could live together forever near their favorite tree. Chapter 5. He had an old car. It was never moved. It sunk in the mud as if it had grown up from it like any other plant. Only it was clearly not a plant. It was, in every sense of the word, a man-made creature. Their hands would caress the deep red leather like silk against the skin. They knew it was flesh, knew it could sense the awe in their touch. They played games inside the car. It was a favorite hiding place. Crouching uncomfortably on the floor like a terrified animal, they would dream about what it would be like to never be found. But they were always found. She particularly liked hiding in the car, locking all the doors so no one could get inside. She liked grinning through the glass at the face of grown-ups as they pleaded with her to open the door. She liked watching their terror. She sometimes felt terror. Once her mother was in the hospital, and Sister Ray, her father's mother, came to take care of them. They never understood why anyone needed to take care of them. Deep down inside, they were afraid that this anonymous someone was coming to take their mother's place. They did not want another caretaker. They wanted only Mama. Because she was not Sister Ray's favorite, she dreaded her coming. She came anyway, with her stern face the color of shiny bright coal, the color of darkness, the face she had given to her son. It was whispered that she did not care for this particular little one because her face was not even thinking about being brown enough, was not even changing in the sun. This particular little one heard the whispers. She bitterly resented this hatred. It was her first rejection. She wanted to hide from it, so naturally, she chose the car. It was the safest hiding place. There, one could be found and not found at the same time. Only this hiding she did not want to do alone, so they, her brother and sisters, joined her. At first, they did not roll the windows up. They just locked all the doors. They waited for Sister Ray to discover that they were all gone, that the house was too quiet. When she finally sensed them missing and couldn't find them in the house, they could hear her calling. She came outdoors searching. They quickly rolled the windows up and crouched on the seats, their hot young bodies touching one another as they laughed. It wasn't working. She did not think to look in the car. They rolled the windows down and called to her. She stood still, staring at them for a minute as if she could not believe her eyes. They were so close, and yet she felt such fear. The corners of her mouth began to tighten. She looked at them, cold and hard. It was the look that communicated the pain of punishment before the switches tied together would tear and burn the flesh. They looked at her and could feel the burning. They closed the windows tight, shutting off the little cracks they had wanted for air, the little cracks that enabled them to hear her ordering them to get out this minute. Defiant, determined, they refused to budge, even though they were beginning to feel afraid. Their resolve was weakening. They knew the longer they remained in the car, the more intense the punishment. They wanted to relent, but the particular little one, the one who was not her favorite, couldn't resist a last rebellious display. She spit right in the direction of that stern face. Only the rolled-up window kept it from reaching the target. Shocked, they opened the doors and ran, leaving her sitting alone, contemplating the coming punishment. Chapter 6. Terror fascinated her. She wanted to understand its ability to arouse. In her child mind, it was always associated with cars. She decided then never to learn to drive. They were in the yard playing with a 4-year-old. They had been warned about staying on the sidewalk, out of the street. No one ever thought that those words sidewalk, street, like the concrete they were both made of, merged into one big stretch for a 4-year-old imagination. When she moved into the street, it was as if it did not exist as a place where cars might come. She could not even hear them. It was a good thing then for the little girl that the car was not moving very fast, that the driver saw her and slowed down, that the other passenger called out. It was a good thing that the older children watching yelled her name, ran to grab her. Standing there holding the child's hand, the child who was not crying because all the moment's terror had communicated itself unspoken in every bit of her body, she recalled the terror she felt, the terror in the eyes of the driver, the passenger, momentarily flashing like lightning, then gone. The scene replayed itself over and over. The sounds, the screech of brakes, the smell, the terror of the child, the terrorized parent spanking the child to communicate sidewalk, street, car hurt. She was stunned. They always went for drives. It was one way the family, and mostly the mother, could get out of the house and into the street. They would drive around visiting family, looking at neighborhoods. The slow movement of the car in summer heat always lulled her into trance-like sleep. She forgot about its ability to arouse terror. Suddenly, its stopping would remind her, at any moment, the brakes could screech. The child living inside her could be run down. They lived near the railroad tracks. Sitting in the hot car with the silent man and the woman, trying ever so hard to please, they would count the number of cars in the train. They would imagine places the train would take them. They would sink into the sound of the whistle as if it echoed every promise of adventure and return. Trains were without terror. They could take you everywhere and bring you back safe, in one piece, in one body. When the trains were coming, red warning lights would flash. But they did not always work on the side of town where the poor and unwanted lived. She could not remember if the lights were flashing that day. She remembered that they had begun to move across the tracks when the car came to a stop. They waited as the father tried to get the car going, listening to the sounds as he turned the key again and again, muttering words that explained nothing to the silent listeners who had already begun to feel worried, afraid. He got out to look under the hood, to find the problem, fix it. They sat there speechless and thirsty, fear drying their throats like sand on a desert. They sat there longing for circuses and vanilla ice cream, quiet only because they feared punishment. They feared that any moment the trains with all the cars they loved, with the bright red cabooses they took to be emblems of victory, would have no time to stop for an unmoving car. They and the car would be crushed. Whether she saw the train coming, she was never able to say. Only that she felt it, felt terror rising in her, like a fierce tide washing away all the remnants of loving observers. Mixed with the terror was a feeling of awe as she saw the father running for safety, saw him standing near the flashing red lights. Chapter 7. She was the closest to her brother. Not only were they just months apart in age, but they looked alike. They looked like twins, even though he was older. Like twins, they shared the same dreams and longings, the same devotion to one another. Strangely enough, it was a toy that separated them, that forced upon them different roles, different identities. She remembered the toy, a bright red wagon. They shared possession of it, but they had different roles and relationship to it. She was to ride in the red wagon, and he pulled it. She was to ride in it because she was a girl, a would-be princess whom some rich prince would come seeking, take away to his palace, and keep her there in splendor forever. He was to pull it because he was a boy, a would-be prince who would do all the hard work, slay the dragons, fight the slimy creatures, challenge the fat, ugly men, so that he could carry away the beautiful princess. He never carried her any further than the corner of the street, and all the while he complained bitterly about how awful it was pulling her, how he wanted a turn sitting in the wagon. Sometimes he would cry. That was just how much he wanted to be pulled in the red wagon. She did not mind pulling him. It was grown-ups like Papa, her great-grandfather, who had trouble seeing her pull that big boy in the wagon. When they finally got daring enough to go around the corner, he would immediately dump her out and demand that he be pulled. Her legs were short and fat. His were long. She could not pull as fast as he wanted her to, but he urged her on, watching with glee as the little fat legs struggled to move him fast, faster. Struggled to give him the fastest ride of them all. Her struggle to give him the fastest ride made the boy happy, so happy that he never wanted to take turns. He only wanted her to pull and pull him. It was because of this that she began to assert her girl rights, to tell him that he was the boy and should pull her. He rarely listened, so she would threaten to tell the grown-ups. He would always say, "Tell them," knowing all the time that she would not, that she hated to see him punished. If he was punished, she would want to be punished too. Even if they did not punish her, she would cry with him. Sometimes the father and the great-grandfather would find out that the boy rarely pulled the girl. They would be standing, towering over him, speaking in harsh, big voices, explaining that he was the boy and should do this, explaining to him that if he did not do what boys should do, they would take the toy away, give it to the girl only, not let them share it. She was always standing in the background listening, waiting to hear the boy tell her when they were alone that he hated her because she was a girl. She grew up not remembering why the red wagon had been so important. She grew up and found that the red wagon of her memory had never existed. Going through boxes of old black and white photos, she found many of herself plump and unsmiling, seated in a wheelbarrow with the boy brother holding the ends as if at any moment he would dump her out. In the photos, the boy looks very happy and self-important. She looks apprehensive, unsure. Seeing that the toy of her memory was a wheelbarrow, she understood why there had always been bruises, dirty, torn clothes. She never understood why she would have fallen out of a wagon, but a wheelbarrow she could understand. She could understand the boy's pleasure, his longing, his constant sorrow. No one could tell her what happened to the red wheelbarrow. No one knew whether it was kept at the house of Papa, the great-grandfather. They could not remember playing with it anywhere else. He lived on a side of town where there were sidewalks. Maybe that is why they only played with it there. Maybe it disappeared because of their constant fighting, because of the boys whining. Maybe he made it disappear.